Nile, going down the river. It was very hot, and on board there was a German couple. The wife, Helga, dressed in a rather mannish fashion, with severe gray-brown suits with large lapels, very wide ties with big knots, tweeds and riding boots, and a hunter's jacket with a pith helmet. She smoked long, brown cigarettes, and she wore her hair very short. Her husband, Ernst, on the other hand, dressed in bright colors. He wore his hair down to his shoulders, intertwined with brightly colored threads, blue and yellow and purple and green and magenta and ochre and burnt cream and mauve and teal. He wore open-toed sandals with a slight elevation of the heel, and he carried a medium-sized leather purse over his shoulder. He had an earring and an onyx and turquoise ring on his right thumb. And he wore pendants, big gold medallions, the size of ashtrays and plates and platters. Sometimes in the evenings he'd wear a vest of beaded fringe that hung almost to his knees that would sparkle, or a silk and ermine floor-length cloak with a high Elizabethan collar trimmed in fur. He also liked to wear a long scarf that was yellow, with bright pink flowers all over it. He liked kilts, skirts, muumuus, dashikis, long floor-length gowns, lace gloves, berets. And sometimes he'd tie his hair up in braids in cornrows, with lots of little buttons and confetti, and small nails, chopsticks, demitasse spoons, threads, ribbons, elastic rubber bands, lighting filaments, batteries, small cheeses, and little bows of human hair that he would cut off of people he would meet. He had mining interests in Egypt, and he was about to sign a major agreement with the Egyptian government. That's why he and his wife were going to Cairo, in order for him to take meetings with leading Egyptian political leaders. Now, also on this ship were two priests, Paolo and Glorio, who looked exactly alike. They had identical features, the same tone of voice, the same gestures. But only one of them would show up to dinner. There was always a place set next to him, but his fellow priest would never appear. And if you'd visit one in their cabin, the other one was never there. And when one would be strolling on the deck, the other would be asleep in the hold. So they were never seen at the same time, at the same place. Yet whenever you would talk to one of them, he would always discuss the other one in very critical terms, very judgmental, and they both claimed to despise each other. It was really embarrassing to hear the way they dishonored each other behind each other's backs. Also on board was the Egyptian vice prefect of Cairo. He was very old, at least in his 80s, wheelchair bound. His legs were paralyzed. He smoked Egyptian filter cigarettes and coughed into a bloodied pink handkerchief. He was always bedecked in all the finery of his rank, with medals and pins and ribbons and bells and small dried parts of enemies that he'd killed in battle. He had a dried ear and an eyeball hanging off of chains across his chest. The German couple, Ernst and Helga, had a little schnauzer that loved Helga, but for some reason hated Ernst, and it actually bit the husband a great many times, so that part of his earlobe had been severed, He had a little scar in his nose. He was missing the first joint of his middle finger. And when you looked closely, you could see bite holes in his clothes. They were not exactly in tatters, but the taffeta was a little torn and the silk had little patches in it. It was clear that a slow process of attrition was taking place, that the man was slowly being eaten by the dog, that the dog was very, very slowly devouring him, doing it by infinitesimal increments. The dog was also incontinent. It would make messes all over the ship, and nothing was ever done about it. And it barked incessantly. And at the dinner table, it would beg for scraps. It would rub up against your knees. Then it would try to mount your leg, and before you knew it, it would ejaculate. But nobody said anything about it. Everyone was too embarrassed. So you'd subtly wipe your pants with your napkin. But mostly, the dog would sit down next to you at the table and bear down on you with its eyes while you were eating. You'd feel extremely uncomfortable and self-conscious because the dog had this look of utter despair and longing and resentment, so you could barely bring yourself to eat. And yet when someone would suggest removing the dog, Helga, the wife, refused. She'd say, "Don't let it bother you." Now, there was also on this boat a Hawaiian sumo wrestler called Takamatsu. He was there with his entourage. His next bout was in Cairo. And he also was placed, along with the German couple, Ernst and Helga, and the Egyptian vice prefect, and one of the two priests, either Paolo or Claudio, whoever happened to show up, at the captain's table. And you could tell there was a spark between Helga and Takamatsu. She helped him with his napkin, and she was teaching him how to eat with a fork because he'd always eaten with chopsticks and he didn't have a good feel for the Western tradition. He kept dropping his utensils and picking them up backwards. For example, he held his fork by the tines. And Helga was talking suggestively, asking what it was like to wrestle, to have a man so big have his arms wrapped around you, hugging you so tightly. Asking him if it was embarrassing to appear almost naked in front of so many people. She was very aggressively flirting with him. And you could tell that Ernst, her husband, was being humiliated. Everyone was embarrassed. And then Ernst began to make sardonic remarks about how sophisticated it was to see two fat men trying to push each other off a platform. What a highly evolved and subtle sport it was. And he tried to draw Takamatsu out ironically about sumo wrestling while subtly mocking him, so that everyone at the table knew he was being condescending. But he was acting as if he was sincerely interested. He asked Takamatsu, "Aside from weighing more than your opponent, what other advantages are there? Does the wind play any part in the outcome of the match? Oh, and are sumo wrestlers allowed to marry each other? I hear that all these sumo fights are fixed. Is that true? Has your thong ever come off in the middle of a match? Did I read something about it falling off in a championship bout in Yokohama?" And always, Takamatsu maintained his dignity. But maybe it was because he didn't quite understand Ernst either. His English was limited. He'd nod and smile. And then, near the end of the meal, Ernst became very silent and looked a little pale. And he left the table, complaining of a migraine. But Helga did not leave with him. She stayed behind and had a drink too many and continued to flirt very overtly. And then she and the sumo wrestler disappeared and were not seen for the remainder of the evening. and we could hear Japanese folk music. And in the music, there were cries and wails of a woman, all emanating from the stateroom of Takamatsu. Meanwhile, Ernst was seen late into the night with the schnauzer on a leash, walking on the deck. Until apparently, while Ernst was ill, vomiting over the side of the ship, the dog pulled the leash free, broke away, and ran off. And that was the last Ernst saw of him. And when Helga returned to their cabin at 6 a.m. and learned what had happened, she demanded that they go right to the captain and have the ship searched. At first, the captain refused to do it, until Ernst reminded him that he was part owner of the shipping line. And so the search took place. But the dog was nowhere to be found. 2 days later, a funeral was held for the schnauzer. They took the dog's wicker basket with its little plush red cushion, and pipes were blown, and they shot off flares. And one of the two priests spoke, Claudio. Paolo couldn't attend. He was apparently sick in his cabin. The captain also made a short speech. He, too, had had a dog who had died on his ship, and he knew the pain of such a loss. And he spoke of how a dog was valuable for a ship. He was good for morale, always kept people's spirits up, and that the schnauzer would be missed, and also that he knew that if the dog had fallen asleep in the sea, it would be a good home, because the sea was a good mother to her children. And then the basket was lowered into the water. And after that, we never saw Ernst and Helga together again. And the death of the dog cast a pall on the rest of the trip. The weather became overcast. And then we were passing a section of the Nile that was notoriously treacherous. And the captain had to maneuver very carefully, and the toilet suddenly all backed up, and the ship had a fetid odor. And one evening we were served a fish souffle that was rotten or contaminated, and everyone became ill. There was a lot of vomiting and diarrhea. The vice prefect's hand was shaking so much that when he lit a cigarette, he accidentally set fire to a drape in the library, and it filled with flames and smoke, and there was a mild panic, but everything was brought under control. And from then on, Helga barely came out of her cabin, and you'd see Ernst in the bar all the time, drinking. And then, the last night of the voyage, I was sitting in the library with the vice prefect of Egypt and the ship's doctor, an Indian from New Delhi. We were smoking cigars and drinking brandy when the vice prefect told us the truth of what had happened that fateful night. But first he made us swear an oath of silence. And the vice prefect told us that early in the morning, just before the sun came up, during the twilight period, just before dawn, when everything was sort of suspended and he couldn't sleep, as he hadn't been able to the entire cruise, he'd hoisted himself into his old wooden wheelchair and had taken himself out onto the deck, where he thought he'd watch the sun come up and get a breath of fresh air. And just as he was dozing off, he heard a strange, high-pitched noise. At first, he didn't know what it was. He thought it was in the rigging. There were so many sounds on a ship. Then he heard this noise again, this high-pitched yelp, which was muffled. When he saw a dark, colorfully dressed figure with a billowing purple robe and a bright magenta hood tied with a yellow ribbon, staggering across the deck, holding something wrapped in a blanket. And he realized it was Ernst, and that he was holding the dog. And he saw Ernst toss it overboard, then scurry back into the darkness. and I asked him, "How could you keep silent when so many people went through so much trouble and effort to look for a dog whom you knew was already dead? Wasn't it your duty to come forward when the whole ship was engaged in a search for almost 6 hours, all on false pretenses?" And the Egyptian vice prefect explained that Ernst was the chairman of the German National Board of Trade. He had sizable mining interests in Egypt. The Egyptian government was in the midst of crucial negotiation with Ernst's German company over mineral rights and land rights. It was a very important deal for Egypt that would bring in billions of dollars and create thousands of jobs if the discussions could be concluded favorably. So he had decided to maintain a discreet silence about the murder of the dog. We all shifted position and poured another round of brandy and fell silent when the ship's doctor began to speak. He said, "Your story certainly contains a surprise and certainly casts another light on what happened that night. But there's even more to your story that only I know. And I will tell you now, if you both take a vow of silence." And so we took another vow of silence, and again another box of cigars was opened. And although the three of us never saw each other again, we became brothers for that night. And the Indian doctor spoke the night the husband, Ernst, came to him with a migraine headache, the same night of that dinner party. He had the little schnauzer with him in the office waiting room. And he wanted something for the migraine, and he also wanted some medication for another nick from the dog. He was bleeding slightly from his ankle. "And just to be on the safe side, I gave him a quick neurological once-over," the Indian said. "I checked his eyes, his vision, his reflexes, and I instantly recognized the major effects of brain cancer. His condition is terminal, and death is imminent." And then the doctor said that he experienced an epiphany in which he bonded with this poor man. He suddenly realized how much alike he and Ernst were. They were both outsiders. They'd both worked so hard at being decent men and gotten nothing but condescension. Ernst was a major industrialist, but he was not a self-made man. His grandfather had been a steel manufacturer during the First World War. His father had expanded the business, and he, Ernst, had been merely an heir to the Mussendorf steel foundries, the fortunes of the company having gone down since he'd taken over. He was not the man his father had been, or his grandfather, and he'd married a domineering, mannish woman, a woman just like his own father. She even looked like his father. So what happened was that my heart went out to him, the Indian said. This poor, lonely man, living in a world he doesn't understand, led around by a woman with a dog that's slowly eating him. And I told him the truth, that he only has 2 months to live. And I advised him that if there was anything that he'd always wanted to do, something that he'd never had the nerve to do, that tonight he should act for the first time in his life. Little did I know that it would give him license to murder this animal, this spoiled, despicable schnauzer. "Can murder ever be a life-affirming act?" the Indian doctor suddenly asked. And we had a very interesting philosophical exchange about this. The Indian said that he felt that by throwing the dog overboard, Ernst had freed himself of the tragedy of his life, so that he would die free rather than a slave. He would die a man rather than a dog. That he was in fact drowning the dog in himself. And that by remaining married to Helga, he had been permitting himself to be both metaphorically and literally devoured. The Egyptian vice prefect felt, on the other hand, that it was the coward's way out to kill the dog. Impetuous, ill thought out, and the act of a stupid, not a wise man. It would have made more sense if Ernst had moved to another stateroom from his wife and filed for divorce. But at this point, the vice prefect had something else on his mind. He was suddenly deeply concerned about the trade agreements that might fall through if Ernst died before he signed them. We were coming into Cairo that morning, and he decided to push the meeting up to the following day. And shortly after we docked in Cairo, Ernst had separated from his wife. The sumo wrestler had gone off with his entourage. And Helga, now alone, disembarked with her bags and caught a taxi to the Cairo Hilton. And the Indian doctor prepared for his next cruise. And the vice prefect went to the Egyptian Ministry of Affairs, where in the course of preparing for the meeting of the following day, he died in his wheelchair. And his body was put on display in the Egyptian Political and Neurological Museum. And one of the two priests, Paolo or Claudio, no one's sure, although he said he was Paolo, was seen leaving the ship. He said the other priest had already gone on shore the night before in a special dispensation. But years later, Paolo left the priesthood, claiming that the death of his companion priest, Claudio, had so unhinged him that it had undermined his faith. And he ended up running a brothel in the red light district of Cairo and sank into a life of utter dissipation and got syphilis and lost one eye in an explosion in his drug laboratory. So it was a pretty ill-fated journey, this boat trip, that seemed to hinge on the dog. And looking back on it now, it's hard to really know what to think about it all. It's hard to draw a conclusion. But when I reflect on it, which I often do, I ask myself, is it a good thing to know your destiny? And I find it highly ironic that the vice prefect actually passed away many years before the death of Ernst, although he was privy to the knowledge of Ernst's imminent death. And I ask myself, was Ernst killing the dog so at least something would die before he did? And why did his wife humiliate him at the table with the sumo wrestler? Was she really attracted to Takamatsu? Or did she use him to goad her husband? Maybe what had happened had more to do with Ernst and Helga than the sumo wrestler. Maybe her wails and cries in the wrestler's room were intended for Ernst to hear. I was also surprised, much later, to learn that the Indian doctor had lost his medical license for incompetence. He'd bungled a couple of surgeries, had operated on the wrong part of a person's anatomy, had removed the wrong organs. And Ernst never did develop brain cancer, and he pulled out of the trade agreement with Egypt and moved back to Germany, where he lived to a ripe old age and died quietly in his sleep. His wife, Helga, at the Hilton Hotel in Cairo, a few days after the boat trip, was found dead of an overdose of laudanum mixed with morphine and schnapps. And a few months later, the dog's body washed up on the coast of Normandy, exactly where the landing was made by the Americans on June 6th, over 50 years ago. And what was left of its body was found by some French children on the beach, and they buried it. And no one knows this but the children and myself, because I was in a small village right on the coast, studying earthworms as related to the timing of Eisenhower's decision to invade. And the next time that ship went out on the Nile, it went down. It sank slowly, with everyone on board. is pulling you forward, as if you're in the hand of God, or in one of God's veins, or anywhere in his bloodstream. Maybe the boat is a thought in the mind of God. When I'm on the river, I think of frying pans, of cabbage soup, and the smell of my younger brother's socks. It was my 12th birthday when I found my brother hanging from the shower nozzle with a note pinned around his neck asking me to dry him. And I was so frightened and shaken that for some reason I still to this day cannot fathom. I averted my eyes and looked down at the floor, and suddenly, before me, I saw a pair of my brother's socks, which I bent down and brought to my nose and inhaled deeply. And that odor still lingers in my nostrils today, particularly when I'm on the river. And the river also makes me think of a fight at the dinner table between my mother and father. My mother screaming at my father, so vicious, so ugly, and hurtful. My father sweating, perspiration running down his face. My mother attacking him for his uselessness, his weakness. So, whenever I hear people quarrel like that, I think of the river. The river also reminds me of a school chum who accidentally speared our track coach with a javelin, severing his spine, paralyzing him from the waist down. The javelin was in such a delicate place on the man's back that they were afraid that if they removed it, he might become a quadriplegic. So they left the javelin where it was. And you would see him in the wheelchair with the javelin sticking up out of his back, like an aerial. And the boy who caused this accident quit the team and was so guilt-ridden that he was killed in a car accident while driving drunk and on drugs. So when I stand on the edge of the boat, gazing down at the river, I think of him. Also, I remember the lingering illness of my grandfather. First, he lost his memory. Then he had a series of strokes, some bypass surgery, a liver transplant. And then, as the result of a series of accidents, he had a metal plate on the side of his forehead and an artificial joint built into his right knee. And he had a shunt in his brain that drained off excess liquid, the consequence of an aneurysm. He was also deaf in one ear and had had laser surgery on one of his eyes, which had left him with a white film over his pupil, which he disguised with different high-fashion eye patches. He had a plaid eye patch, a damask one, a linen one. He had eye patches made of wicker, stained glass, little wooden cups. Sometimes the eye patches showed faces of prominent politicians or literary figures. He also had a tumor on his foot, but his will to live was so highly developed and so strong that his heart continued to pound strongly. Even though it wasn't even his own heart by then, it was the heart of a woman who died in a car accident in Texas, just as she was about to attend a music festival there. She was an aspiring Celtic harpist. Also, the river reminds me of the time when my cousin Julia had a nervous breakdown. She was studying at the Sorbonne when she began to speak in an unintelligible language. Actually, at first, some researchers and academicians in the study of linguistics thought that perhaps it was an ancient tongue. But it turned out that the language she spoke bore no resemblance to any other. In fact, it wasn't a language. It sounded like a language. It had the cadence of language. But ultimately, it meant nothing to anyone. As a matter of fact, a number of essays, monographs, articles, poems, novellas, short stories, episodic television programs, short films, features, documentaries, musical comedies, and reviews were produced about her, but none of them really captured the subtle and inexplicable modes of shading of the tragedy that followed. The tragedy of one man who believed that Julia was indeed speaking an authentic ancient language. Heinrich Plosky, whose career was shattered. He lost his wife, his post, his collection of antique prostheses was confiscated. All because he spoke up for her at the National Language Convention of 84, the one in Helsinki. He was vilified, hung in effigy, utterly discredited, and completely ruined. I think of him. I think of the river. The river is a series of tragic stories. I see the countryside go by. A child standing by himself in the backyard of a house that has been gutted. An abandoned truck upside down in a field. A dying industrial town. A shell of its former self. Mines closed. Streets empty. The sound of the river is like the wail of a woman. A call of regret and mourning and loss and despair and yearning. The river takes you to the ocean, to your final resting place.
Another incident when I was
was about to be trampled by a herd of wildebeests. They were running from a brush fire, charging down the plain, and I couldn't outrun them, and they were spread out so wide that I could do nothing but take out my small shovel, and I quickly dug a very slight trench, and I laid down in it. And then I sprinkled some earth on top of me. And I did incur some injuries. I broke two ribs, and I had some abrasions and contusions and a ruptured spleen. But anyone else would have been killed. And so I was, in every respect, a survivor. And then, one evening, we were sitting around the fire when I reached for the bourbon, and some fool at the table asked me about the numbers on my wrist. And I told him it was the mark of the military club that I'd belonged to as a young man, a fencing club in which all of the men had to undergo a rite in which each member had a number tattooed on his wrist. And there was a young woman at the table, Maria, Catholic, religious, beautiful, petite, intelligent, and she had a wonderful sense of humor, and she was a practical joker. Once we found her lying on her hammock, foaming at the mouth, her body twitching, convulsing, her eyes dilating. And everybody gathered around, filled with fear and anxiety. And then she jumped up and laughed gaily. And so she endeared herself all the more because we were so glad that she was all right. And then once she put dummy shells in my rifle. And when a huge bull elephant bore down on me and I was firing shot after shot at him, it was incomprehensible to me that the elephant wouldn't go down. I couldn't figure out why I seemed to be missing him because I was a crack shot. Nothing I did seemed to slow the elephant down at all. And finally it came down on me and it gored me with its tusks and lifted me with its trunk and threw me down on the ground and trampled me for almost 30 seconds until the bearers were able to drive him off with sticks. But when I found out what she'd done, I found the whole thing highly amusing, even though I did lose the hearing in one ear for the next 2 years, and part of my jaw was broken. And so Maria and I became best of friends. Now, at waterholes, you'd see pelicans and egrets and flamingos and water buffalo and hippopotami and other animals all bathing, all soaking in this primeval mud. And sometimes you'd see animals being taken down by crocodiles. There would be a sudden splash in the middle of an otherwise still lake when a crocodile got a baby antelope in his jaws, and the antelope would suddenly freeze and go still. And almost before you knew what had happened, the crocodile would pull its prey under the water. And a moment later, all the animals would go back to drinking as though nothing had happened. If they had been human beings, they would have fled that place. They would have been running for their lives. But the animals knew that it was just a part of their existence. Or maybe it was because they had very short attention spans. Or maybe they took a philosophical position that human beings are not capable of. Perhaps they were willing to accept that death is part of life. Perhaps they experienced a sense of resignation. In the evenings, our Kenyan guides would cook some of the day's kills. And they'd sing show tunes to entertain the guests. They sang the entire score from Oklahoma, including Oh, What a Beautiful Morning and Everything's Up to Date in Kansas City. And they sang Send in the Clowns by Stephen Sondheim. and Maria from West Side Story, and Cole Porter's Begin the Begin. And late at night, when everyone had gone to sleep, Maria and I lifted ourselves out of our tents and walked down to the water, stripped off our clothes in the moonlight, and very quietly joined the animals in the watering hole. The zebras didn't shy away when we patted their flanks and tussled their little black manes. And the water buffalo and wildebeests didn't mind when we stroked their legs. And sometimes, holding hands, we'd watch as two animals mated. I told Maria that back at my lodge in Nairobi, I had a haul of animal trophies. But I had mounted not the heads of animals, but their rear legs and tails. So that when you walked into the room, it looked as if the animals were all fleeing through the walls, leaping into another dimension. I felt that it more accurately reflected the true conditions of life. That everyone, ultimately, must leave. And where they're going, not even they can be sure of. And during that safari, I was fascinated by the concept of time. I had a number of wristwatches running up my arm. I had a watch on my ankle, a watch embedded into the handle of my knife, another just beneath my compass. My belt buckle was a watch. My camera had a watch built into it. My rifle had a digital time readout. And my bearers had to carry my huge wooden pendulum grandfather's clock. Not to mention the fact that I had a 5-foot-tall hourglass filled with the sand of the area. In this way, I could get in touch with the feelings of the land by measuring its movements in time, by the sifting of the indigenous sand in the giant hourglass, which was welded to the Land Rover. I also carried a small metronome on my left shoulder. Yes, I was obsessed by time. And I was fascinated by the increments. The very, very small increments by which we grow old. I wrote a book of poems that I privately published called The Geology of the Face. A series of very short haiku-like rhymed verses that reflected on the vagaries, questions, and conundrums of time. Included also were daily portrait photographs of my face over the period of 6 years, as it aged, that came in a flip book. You'd press your thumb against it, and in the course of 20 seconds, you'd see me go from the age of 34 to 40. one evening, we came to a village on the banks of a river. A village where there was known to be a distinguished German anthropologist and linguist named Hans Müller. We passed huts with thatched roofs. And the people of the village wore primitive nose rings and sticks in their ears, and grass skirts and sarongs and scarves wrapped around their bodies, and leather pelts of animals, combined with Ray-Ban sunglasses and Nike sneakers and Rolex wristwatches. Many of them were tattooed, marked rather interestingly with ancient tribal insignia, as well as corporate logos. For instance, someone would have the tattoo of an ancient spear on one arm and the Bell telephone or Nabisco logo on the other. One individual had a spider on the small of his back, weaving a web, radiating out to the shoulders and to a pair of McDonald's golden arches. It was a generic African village with a German sensibility. Everything was laid out in perfectly straight lines. There were flower gardens with little picket fences, trellises, fountains, statuaries with Greek gods and goddesses. The windows of the huts had damask linen curtains. And there was one building built from limestone and concrete that had Greek columns and Roman arches and resembled the Parthenon. And as we entered the village, we heard shrieks and sobs, a dirge-like calling. And all the statuary was draped in black material. In fact, everyone was dressed in black. The people of the village wore black headbands and black armbands. The thatched huts had black crepe hanging from the apertures. The grand palace was bedecked in black wreaths. Clearly, the entire village was in mourning. And then, we saw the body of a white man being borne on a litter from the palace, put on a wagon, which was drawn by two oxen. And we could hear drumming, and there was some polka music being played. The body was draped in scarves and garlands and vegetable flowers, and surrounded by small skulls. And it was apparently Hans Müller. And the entire village formed a procession behind the wagon. And then, for some inexplicable reason, I removed my handgun from my holster. And it looked to me like a foreign object. Grotesque. Frightening, ugly, incorrect, misshapen, and deformed. And I threw it into the bushes. I couldn't even bear to touch it. And we followed the procession until it arrived at the burial site, a dirt mound in the middle of a little grove of low-lying bushes, where a hole had been dug. The people of the village formed a circle around this hole, and the litter bearers lifted the body off the wagon and deposited it next to the hole. And then they began to play drums, and they built a fire in which they threw all their black arm and wristbands. And the music got faster, and the people danced more frenetically. And high priests bedecked with feathers and gold jewelry came forward, and they lit torches from burning oil pots. And when things had reached a passionate, frenzied state, suddenly the body sat up, and the drumming stopped, and everyone fell to the ground. And the man we thought had been dead raised his arms to the heavens. And he recited a short, simple chant, which he repeated over and over again in an undecipherable language. And then, rather than getting into the wagon, he walked back to the village. And there was an air of silence and reverence, and a single drum beat as everyone fell into a single line following him at a respectful distance. And it became clear to me that this was a ritualistic event, suggesting the death and rebirth of a god. And then, suddenly, I was trying to remember where I'd thrown my gun, because I realized that this man was not Hans Muller, but none other than the butcher, Erich Schmiel, the former commandant of the concentration camp where my parents had been put to death, I myself barely surviving. Schmiel, a Nazi fugitive who'd found sanctuary in this village by the river. And I finally managed to retrieve my revolver from the bushes, and I went directly to the palace, and I shot Schmiel in the head at point-blank range, and I took the body with me back to Nairobi, and I had it mounted in the Great Hall, along with the other animals, in the same style, with only his rear end and legs sticking out of the wall. Looking back, I can't help but feel that we will never be able to unravel the infinitely complex, multifaceted knot, a very tightly tied cluster of meaning, curtained by mystery, which is in turn enveloped in an air of unpredictability, which is imbued in a profound sense of malaise, underpinned by doubt. In other words, do we look at the elementally unclear manner in which meaning, encased in a sphere of ignorance, is manifested by a metaphor, which inevitably results in a sense of dislocation and anomie and loss, while perhaps one has really gained immeasurably from an insight that a sense of loss can induce? So now I've become a stockbroker. I'm married to Maria. We have three children. We live in a suburban gated community. All the houses look identical, but are turned at different angles and are painted different colors. My children go to the local school. Maria is on the local auxiliary and gives dance lessons. We vacation yearly on the Rhine. Spend our summers there. We play bridge every Tuesday night. I play the violin in a local chamber group, and she gives lectures on Teutonic myths with slideshow demonstrations. And this whole experience I went through has inspired me to write an opera. It's already in workshop, and I think I might get a movie deal out of it. They're going to mount it in Berlin, but they're only going to show the last half of it, because that's what I do with everything I mount.
You've been listening to Joe Frank, Flashback. This program was called The River, originally broadcast in 1996, created in collaboration with Arthur Miller, featuring vocalist Judith Owen and keyboardist Todd Cochran, narrated and produced by Joe Frank.